Welcome to Stage 16. We are back, and we are going to talk a little bit about some movie news here, just to start us off. And then the bulk of the episode, we're going to talk about the great Bruce Willis.
Yes.
So you have O'Banion and Roberts here, and let's jump right in. What do you got, Roberts?
Well, as far as movie news, and I have to say, Roadhouse has always been one of my favorite movies of all time. I just love that film. And remakes scare the hell out of me. Total Recall remake sucked. RoboCop remake sucked.
Point Break, yes.
But this one just seems to be of a little higher caliber. And I'll tell you why. Because I really like Doug Liman, who's directing. I really think he's an interesting director and an interesting filmmaker to do that. And I like Gyllenhaal. I've always liked Jake Gyllenhaal, who's taken over the Patrick Swayze part. And I just think he's an interesting actor, and he makes interesting choices. He's never really broken through kind of to that true A-list, but he continues to work in interesting roles. And I just don't think he would sign on for something like this if it were of the caliber of the three remakes that were just mentioned. And I like that they're changing the story and they're taking it to, I think it takes place in the Florida Keys, although they're going to film it in the Dominican Republic. And it has kind of a UFC thing where his character used to be a UFC fighter, and they just cast Conor McGregor, and who I would assume is maybe the main henchman, you know, maybe the main bad guy that he has a big fight with. I don't know, but I'm really intrigued with that film and excited about it for sure.
Yeah, it was a surprise to hear that Doug Liman was going to do that, because I thought his sort of dance card was full for the next few years, including doing the Tom Cruise movie in space.
Well, the Tom Cruise movie in space is probably years away still, right? I mean, that's the best case scenario. They're probably filming that in 2 or 3 years, best case. So I don't, I'm sure that he's like, hey, we can go down to Dominican Republic. Probably that movie, Roadhouse, will probably film over 40 days or something like that, you know, just knock it out and have a good time.
Yeah. I wonder who they get to play the Sam Elliott role.
I don't know. You know, that could, I don't know. The Conor McGregor thing, that's what I thought when they cast him. Maybe he is playing that, like his buddy who he used to fight with, since Gyllenhaal's character is a retired UFC fighter. Or maybe he's the bad guy.
They're not that different in age, right? I mean, you could do whatever you want, but Sam Elliott was quite a bit older than Swayze.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, he really wasn't that much older. He just always plays older. Sam Elliott's been like the old guy for 35 years now.
Yeah. They just announced, I don't know if you heard, but Sienna Miller, who I tweeted about her last week. Do you know, you like Sienna Miller?
I do, and I did just see the news about the Costner movie, yeah.
Yeah, so she has joined the Costner Western with Sam Worthington. You know, I tweeted about Sienna Miller last week because that woman is so gorgeous that it's almost like she can't be a creature from Earth. Like, she's just so beautiful. And she's been in some decent movies, but she's been in some terrible movies. But I just kind of, I can't figure out why she's not like a global superstar, like on the level of like Johansson.
You know, I would equate Sienna Miller kind of like Jake Gyllenhaal. Was one of those things where she's a talented actress just like he is, and they've been around for a while now. So, you know, for about 20 years they've been acting, but they've never really broken through to that true A-list. But
yeah, I mean, like, she has a steady career. She's not
right, but for whatever, Hollywood keeps casting them, and I'm good with that. I'm like, you know, not everybody has to be Tom Cruise, you know, and not everybody has to be Scarlett Johansson, but thankfully they continue to work. And, you know, Chris Pine is another example where outside of Star Trek, you know, he's worked for the last 13 years consistently, but he's never been like an A-list box office draw. But he's really interesting actor and continues to work. And I'm happy. And, you know, I have to say this too, Ryan Gosling, another example. Ryan Gosling feels like maybe right now between the Netflix movie and The Fall Guy, which he starts filming this fall. Maybe he's finally at 41, 42 years old about to really bust through the A-list. But for 20 years, he's been kicking around. And every now and then he gets some big movies like First Man, like Blade Runner, and they don't do well. but you know,
they're good films, and he is consistently. I mean, he was good in his little sort of comedic role in Remember the Titans. He's consistently good.
Right.
He's fantastic in Drive. He was good in The Place Beyond the Pine. Like, he's
a great actor.
Reliable, good looking guy. Women want to look at him. Guys want to be him.
Yeah.
I enjoyed The Gray Man, as I think you did too, right? I
love The Gray Man. Yeah, loved it.
It was a good time. So I'm happy about the sequels. As you just said, he's going to do The Fall Guy with David Leitch, who's got Bullet Train in theaters now. And they just added Emily Blunt, which like leveled up that movie in a big way.
Yeah. So Sienna Miller is kind of like, I equate to those actors where it felt like there was a time in Hollywood where actors kind of had their shot. And if it was proved that, yeah, that film didn't open, they're not a draw, done, move on. Then, you know, like we're finished with them, you know, and it feels like we're in a different time now where actors and actresses, even if they get starring roles and they don't work out as they're not big hits, they don't just kind of go away. You know, it's like Hollywood continues to cast. No, maybe they don't cast. And I think the part of that is that the world we're in is so different as far as movies go, where now, you know, Godzilla, Iron Man, like the characters are the stars outside of, frankly, Tom Cruise and, you know, DiCaprio. I mean, there really aren't any true A-listers. You know, you still have Denzel. Yeah. We still have some of these people, but you know, that it's kind of sad.
They're all getting old.
They're all getting old, which leads us into this show's topic, Bruce Willis.
Yeah. So if you listen to the show at all, if you've heard previous episodes, we've talked a lot about Bruce and Roberts. I'm hoping that you're going to share a couple stories, because of the two of us, you're the one who's worked with him. I never got the chance.
Yeah.
But obviously, I mean, you know, started out in television, broke through with Moonlighting with Sybil Shepherd, which sort of a two-hander and more of a comedic drama, I guess. He was a real smart ass. You know, prior to that, he was like a guy that was like a bartender in Jersey and, you know, just kicking around trying to get jobs. And then he gets this TV series and sort of breaks through. But obviously his breakthrough movie was Die Hard.
And it was Die Hard. I've never seen that.
Yeah. And, you know, the story of Bruce is that he was sort of, I think he'd either just finished Moonlighting, like the series had just shut down, or he was on a break from Moonlighting.
I think it was a break. Yeah.
The studio did not want him. 20th Century Fox was like, that guy is not an action hero. That guy is not a movie star. He's a TV personality, and we don't want him.
They offered it to Stallone. They were real close to getting Richard Gere, which in hindsight, I think Richard Gere would have been an interesting choice, but obviously John McClane is Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis is John McClane.
That's the thing. With you that Gere would have been interesting, but there's a softness to Richard Gere.
Yeah.
Even when he's playing, you know, like in Internal Affairs or something where he's the bad guy, there's something about him that's a little gentle almost. And Bruce has that cocky New Jersey thing.
Yeah.
That I don't, you know, and it's weird that Fox didn't want him, because you could see that. That's what David Addison on Moonlighting was. He was like the cocky guy.
But here's the thing. That's what it goes back to what we were just talking about, that was an era in the 80s of movie stars. And Bruce Willis had not proved himself at that. So that what they were being very kind of like, had their blinders on, the studios, and going, who is a movie star that we can put in this movie star role? They weren't thinking outside the box.
And we should say, most movie fans know this, but the original Die Hard, the character was based on this sort of, you know, detective novel kind of series by Roderick Thorpe. And they had made a movie, I guess, in the 60s.
Early 70s,
Frank Sinatra.
Right.
And so Sinatra's contract at that point said that if there were ever any sequels to be made or any other films about that character, that he had to be offered the movie. So it sounds super weird, but Frank Sinatra was offered Die Hard, and thankfully, I think for everyone, passed.
Yes, I would say so. So Die Hard is, I was 10 years old. So 9 and a half when that film came out, but it came out in July of 1988. And I was still, Die Hard's one of those movies where it's the one of the first movies that got me into movies, you know, where I was kind of at that age, 9, 10 years old, where I wasn't, I wasn't watching Disney. I mean, I was into Star Wars. I was into those things, but I was not like into normal kids movies. And I'll never forget, you know, 87, 88, my parents, you know, renting these movies on VHS and going, son, we just watched Lethal Weapon. You got to watch this movie. This movie's awesome. You know, I'm 9 years old. And then a year later, Die Hard, same thing. They rent Die Hard and they go, son, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. And I literally remember, I was living in Little Rock, Arkansas all the time, and I remember watching that film like almost on a constant loop. Like my friends and I would like watch the film, we'd go outside and play in the yard, then we come back in and start it again. You know, it's such an iconic film. And to this day, you know, 34 years later, it is still undeniably one of it's the best, probably just straight action film. You know, like, you know how I feel about Top Gun and Star Wars, certain other action movies, whatever, right? But Die Hard is a straight up action film and is so smart and so well done. And we talk about it a couple times on this show. So like the things we're saying about it are not new to anybody that listens to this show, but Bruce Willis really did own that and really did make that. And it really is one of those things where I don't think it would have been as iconic or as remembered had it had Richard Gere, certainly not Stallone. And look, I love Sylvester Stallone. In fact, I would like to do an entire episode to talk about Stallone and maybe a future episode.
We'll do that too. I mean, look.
But Bruce Willis.
So I'm assuming we're going to do our top five. I'm assuming that your number one and my number one are going to align here. So let's just say what our number ones are for Bruce Willis.
Okay. Number one for me is Look Who's Talking. No, just kidding. It's Die Hard, of course. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So mine too. So let's just dig into that a little bit. For me, so I was, well, you got to tell me, what year was that?
1988.
So I was 13 years old. I was living in Monterey, California at the time. There was a little single screen cinema called the Rainbow Cinema. And I think my mom, I remember pretty vividly, my mom asked me, hey, do you want to go to the movies today? It was like a Saturday. My grandmother was visiting from Southern California. And they said, just pick a movie. Let's go see whatever you want to see. So I picked Die Hard. I didn't really know what it was. I might have seen a couple of television spots where they're like, you know, this movie will blow you through the back of the theater kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, great, okay, trash. Action movie. Cool. I'm in for that. I like the action movie already. So, we go out to the theater sort of having no idea what to really expect. And we got blown through the back wall of the theater. It was crazy. And the thing about Die Hard that people don't, you know, especially younger people now, post Bourne movies and stuff like that, the 80s paradigm, as you sort of just mentioned or referenced, was the big muscle-bound hero, was the Stallone, was Schwarzenegger. There weren't any action heroes that looked like guys that you would see walking down the sidewalk when you left the theater.
Yeah, right.
And so the thing about the way that that McTiernan cast Bruce in that movie, which is a miracle because he really had to sort of convince Fox, and then Willis didn't make it easy on them because he made a play for a big paycheck, which at the time was one of the biggest paychecks ever for an actor in an action film.
It was either $5 or $7 million.
Yeah, it was $5 million.
And it was $5 million.
The rest of all the other studios were like, number one, you're fucking us up. Why would you give this TV guy $5 million? Because now we're all going to have to pay everybody $5 million.
Yeah.
But secondly, like, who the fuck is Bruce Willis? You know? But anyway, he got his payday and he does the movie. And, you know, that's the thing is, like, he looks like a regular guy.
Yeah.
And he looks, you know, you watch Predator, you watch Terminator, any of these movies, you're like, okay, you know, Arnold's not going to get killed.
Yeah, there's no regular guys in Predator or Commando.
Yeah. No. You're like, yeah, Sly's not going to, he might get shot. Maybe, probably not. I mean, Bruce Willis in Die Hard gets shot. His feet are cut open. He just gets his ass kicked consistently. Yeah. He does kick some ass, in fairness, but he gets beaten down hard.
Yeah.
So by the end of that movie, he's limping. He looks fucked up. And nobody had ever seen that before. And it was revolutionary to, you know, action cinema, to showing that lead characters actually don't have to be these invincible sort of machines, oiled up machines.
Yeah.
Just sort of changed everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think about it, it's amazing the audacity and the confidence that at that point in Bruce Willis's career, that he and his agent were able to get that kind of a salary. You know, I mean, you would think that he would have been like, look, I just want the movie, like, just pay me whatever. I mean, you have to pay your dues to get those kind of salaries. And he hadn't paid his dues at that point. But the fact that he dug in and he got, you know, the highest rate, I mean, that's insane. You know, that's Schwarzenegger, that's Stallone.
Why, that's why the studios were like, what are you guys doing?
Well, absolutely. Because Costner, you know, all these leading actors in the 80s were like, well, what the fuck? If he just got $5 million, guess what? I'm getting 10 next time. You know, it's crazy. Exactly. They're like, Mr. Moonlighting, I was in goddamn Commando and Predator. And like, what the hell are you doing? You know? So, yeah, these guys.
Arnold must have called up McTiernan and been like, John, what's happening over there?
Mm-hmm.
I hear you paid this guy $5 million. I didn't make that in Predator.
I didn't make that in Predator. What the hell?
So anyway, yeah. So, I mean, what can you say about Bruce Willis? What can you say about Die Hard? It's a phenomenal film. And you talk about audacity. I mean, who the hell was Alan Rickman then?
Yeah.
I mean, that was his first sort of exposure to American audiences. And I mean, I can't.
That's another thing. You mentioned that. I mean, the show is supposed to be about Bruce Willis, but let's talk about Alan Rickman for a minute because of that role. As perfect as Bruce Willis is in that part, like, you can't see anybody else in it, Alan Rickman deserves 50% of the credit of that film. Because that is one of the all-time written and acted kind of villainous roles, you know, and villain roles, you know, have been around forever, you know, I mean, a lot of them are just kind of standard boilerplate, whatever. Whatever he did with that was so good, and because he was, you know, charming and funny, but then would literally like blow someone's brains out in front of us. I mean, it just was insane what he was doing, and it was really
good. Liked him.
Absolutely.
There was, I mean, you didn't want Bruce Willis to lose at the end of the movie, and you were pretty sure, you know, he wasn't going to, but there was something really attractive about Hans Gruber. And, you know, it could be those John Phillips of London suits.
Yeah.
It can be the way that he, you know, presented how well researched he was as a character. In terms of, like, not only did he know who Takagi was, but he knew Takagi's entire family history. You know, he knew about the plans of the, you know, the company plans of the Nakatomi Corporation, all the stuff they were building. And then, you know, spoiler alert, however many years later we are now, like, the idea that the FBI showing up was always part of his plan. You know, that's crazy to. You got to give credit to Stephen D'Souza for just writing this stuff.
It's one of the tightest action scripts ever written. And it's, you know, it is iconic, and it is a film. There are certain movies that I have had I literally bought every iteration you can imagine. And I bought like several VHS re-releases, several Laserdiscs, several DVDs, several Blu-ray. And now, as of recently as last year, I bought Die Hard on 4K Blu-ray. I mean, that's one of those films I've literally bought it at least 9 or 10 times over. And whatever comes next, you know, it's probably gonna be nothing because everything's just going to be streaming and there will be no physical media. But I will have that 4K Blu-ray that is the quality of it's the best I've ever seen. And I watch it at least once a year, usually around Christmas.
Did you ever come across anybody, I mean, setting Bruce aside, did you ever come across anybody in your career who worked on that you got to talk to?
Yeah, Charlie Pacerni.
Oh, of course, Charlie Pacerni.
And when he would tell me stories about that. And
so do you remember any of those?
What I remember more was stories about him telling me about Die Hard 2, which we'll talk about that in a minute because that's actually number two on my list.
It is on mine too.
let's just walk right into that then. So number two on both our lists is Die Hard 2, and my first exposure to Die Hard 2, I'll never forget it. Early 1990, actually March 2nd, 1990, watching The Hunt for Red October because the teaser trailer.
Oh yeah.
Which to me is still one of the greatest all-time teaser trailers ever made.
We're talking about the he's running through the tunnel and the alarms are going off.
It's not that one. No, that was teaser number one. That was like teaser before they even started filming the movie. Okay. What I'm talking about was teaser number two, where the big like D and then I and then E comes at the screen, you know, and he's, you know, and that because there were three trailers.
Is it the one where you're like, you know, you hear all the voiceovers like somebody shut us down.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. So this actually had footage from the film. They were still filming the movie when this teaser trailer came out. But I remember
there was one that had it would say like, you know, Dulles Airport is the largest airport in the country with.
That is the true. That's the one you're talking about. It's a true teaser where there was no actual footage from the film. It was the voiceovers and what you're talking about. And then it was McClane running down, like running.
Oh, is that the same one? Okay. I forgot.
No, that's the same one. What I'm talking about is a teaser that had footage from the film. And it was teaser number two, where it, you know, it starts out and like someone shut us down and, you know, you see all chaos breaking loose and you see like the SWAT team getting shot and you see, the one character who, you know, works in, I forget his name, one African-American guy, but he goes, you know, someone just shut us down and, you know, better start thinking of a new miracle. And then the trailer makes it look like that they bring in McClane because like a helicopter comes in and Fred Dalton Thompson goes, who the hell is this? You know, and they make it look like that it almost flew in John McClane. Like, well, let's just call him. He can take care of these terrorists. But that's not actually how the story plays out. But
you're talking, they make it look like Barnes called him in.
Yes. Barnes. And you see, you know, the D. And you don't see Bruce Willis's face. You see snippets where the D comes in and then the I and then the E. And you see, like, McClane running. But you don't really know until you see John McClane's face, and then the guy goes,
"You're the wrong guy in the wrong place at the wrong time."
Boom, and then it cuts to McClane's face.
Story of my life.
And that,
yeah,
that
you remember. By the way, we're talking about the great Dennis Franz there as like the head of Dulles Airport Security.
Well, not only that, but Fred Dalton Thompson, you know, running the air tower. I mean, that's a real.
William Sadler is a great villain.
He's a great villain. And what they did, the reason they cast Sadler in the film, they went that route and said, look, we can't do like the guy in a suit, Euro smart, you know, like let's do something totally different. So they went this highly militaristic character, lead villain, and William Sadler cast him in the film to play this just straight up just killer soldier. And yeah, he's awesome. He's awesome in the film.
Yeah.
And it really surprised me, that movie, because granted McTiernan did not direct it, but it had the same stunt coordinator, you know, a lot of the same crew that worked on Die Hard 1 did Die Hard 2, even though the director and the DP were different. A lot of the crew was the same. And it just felt to me exactly like Die Hard 1 to the point where, and I mean that in a good way, and to the point where, I know we're doing like kind of a top five list, but frankly, for me, Die Hard 1 and 2 are on an even keel. Like, it's hard for me to say one is better than the other, which is shocking because, especially with all the Die Hard sequels that came later that were not very good and Die Hard ripoffs, whatever. But Die Hard 2, for a film that was put together and came out 2 years, you know, I mean, that's not much turnaround time. You know, I mean, the film came out, you know, 2 years after the first film, to have it be that tight and that good. And to do, you know, the character of John McClane, Bruce Willis, what he's doing is exactly the same. It's just in a different environment. And, it, you know, it's higher stakes because, like, all these planes in the air. And, I mean, but, it, and, you know, the same thing where his wife is still in jeopardy. You know, he has to save his wife. So certain things that you go, man, they just kind of ripped off Die Hard 1 and just put it in a different setting. It works, like, on so many levels.
And yeah, I mean, they kept the sort of, what do you call it? Shit, what's the word I'm thinking of? Where the claustrophobia of
him, like, under the runway and, like, yeah, corridors.
Like in the Nakatomi Tower or being trapped in this airport and not being able to get out because you gotta, you know, you gotta save everybody. But at the same time, because it's an airport, you've opened it up a little more rather than just going floor to floor in a building. We have all these, you know, we're out on the runway or we're even at the church where the bad guys have set up operations.
I love that. Speaking of the church, that the shootout at the church and the fight at the church where he's fighting the guy and sticks an ice icicle in his eye. Love that whole snowmobile chase. That snowmobile chase is so well done, and it just, it's awesome. Like, I remember watching that. I was 12 years old. I was 11 and a half watching that in the theater, because by this point I was going to movies in theater. So Die Hard 2 saw it on, like, opening night in the theater. And yeah, I just remember thinking, man, this is as good as action movies get, you know?
Yeah.
Fighting on the wing of the plane at the end of the movie. It's so good.
Yeah. The only thing that bummed me out, I remember when it first came out, but I understood why. I mean, he's got one scene in it, but I was bummed that there was no Al Powell. That's the only thing that bummed me out.
Well, he was in it. Remember, he
That's what I'm saying. He calls him and he asks him to, like, you know, check an ID.
Well, I mean, you know, the movie already stretches all sorts of levels of plausibility. It really stretching plausibility if Al Powell just happened to be, oh, now he's not an LAPD officer anymore. Now he's working with Dennis Franz, you know, at the Washington D.C. airport. But I mean, he was in the film. You know, you wanted to see more of him as an Al Powell fan. I got it. Reginald Vell Johnson, the great Reginald Vell Johnson.
Yeah. I mean, but it's still, you know, the movie's great. I was glad they got William Atherton back in there as Thornburg.
Which is another thing that makes it's no sense that he would have to be on the same plane with Holly McClane, but you just go with it. Like, they could have easily left his character out of it, and I don't think anybody would have thought twice about it. Because at that point, it's almost like, well, why do you need to bring back the main FBI agent?
Yeah, but they get so many great moments out of it. I mean, you know, when she steals the taser from the old lady and, like, hits him in the bathroom with it. Like,
yeah.
I remember being in the theater and the audience just clapping. I mean, they were eating it up.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and that's another one where I watch those Die Hards 1 and 2 probably at least once a year.
So you had screenwriter Steven E. D'Souza came back for it. As you mentioned, they did change directors, which was interesting, but Rennie Harlan was really kicking off in the United States. And, you know, it's just, it does everything that a great sequel is supposed to do. It just takes everything that you love from the first one and just ramps it up to the next level.
I want to say, I think the production designer was the same. Obviously, the producer the same, the writer, the effects guys, Al DeSaro and his team were the same. So it was a lot of the crew was the same outside of the director.
I don't think John Vallone, the production designer, did the first film. Let me just check that. I feel like the production designer of the first one was Degovia. Yeah, it was
Degovia. Okay, sorry. So then
John Vallone was the production designer to whatever extent there was a production designer on Predator. So they kept some people from sort of McTiernan's sphere, I guess.
Yeah. And then for me, the Die Hard series lost in quality dramatically. And I don't want to do like a whole thing on every single Die Hard film here, but Die Hard 3 was not really a fan. You liked that film a lot more than I did, but I just, I didn't like bringing Sam Jackson and making it like a buddy film. It's like, to me, it's like they're trying to do a Lethal Weapon deal, and I didn't like that. It didn't feel right. And yeah. Then
I do like it, but
you like it better than I do. And it's nice. Yeah,
they get worse and worse as they go on.
Yeah. And then Die Hard's 4 and 5. Like, I like, funnily enough, you like 3 more than I do. And I like 4 more than you like that one. But Die Hard 5 was one of the biggest, like, steaming pile of shits that probably ever been committed to film, you know? So,
and oddly enough, partly the fault of Bruce. I mean,
oh yeah, you just slap walk through it. You could tell
that,
yeah,
that filmmaker, and I use that term loosely in regard to that movie, had done, you know, like Behind Enemy Lines or something like that. He'd done like 1 or 2 other action pictures for Fox, but you know, it just, Bruce, I think, didn't understand the character anymore. I think he lost the thread on John McClane at some point, because by the time you get to the movie where he's jumping off the 105 freeway in LA onto like a Harrier jet, you know, now it's like, now he's like an X-Men, you know, like he's not regular.
To a degree, I do think though that Live Free or Die Hard kind of, you know, it was not nearly as over the top as what he was doing in Die Hard 5, but you're right. I mean, he jumped the shark a little bit, but I think Live Free or Die Hard is actually not a bad film. I think it's a big mistake that they made it PG-13, and that's just the biggest no-no you can do in the Die Hard world, in my opinion. But I think that they did the best they could with that in trying to put it into the digital era and, you know, bring it up to date, and but still tied into kind of the old John McClane, you know. Yeah. Whereas by the time they got to the next one, it was just Sleepwalk, like X-Men hanging off helicopters, crashing through plate glass,
yeah, jumping building through windows without knowing what's terrible.
It was horrendous. Yeah.
So let's go for our number. Now I have a feeling our number 3 of our top 5 is also going to match, but I think after that we might diverge. So what's your?
We might diverge on number 3. You want me to go first?
Yeah, go.
The Last Boy Scout.
We are in alignment.
Nice. You, me, and Joel Silver, baby. Yeah. Last Boy Scout came out at Christmas of 1991. And that's another one where I remember, you know, the trailer, and just, it's a great trailer.
Joe Hellenbeck's a private detective who's run out of luck. Jimmy Dix is an ex-quarterback who was thrown out of football.
Shane Black wrote that script, and it's such a good script. It's such a tight script. And, you know, Shane Black, obviously the writer of Lethal Weapon, one of the greatest all-time scripts. Forget just action, scripts in general, in my opinion. The Last Boy Scout, I think, is such a good story, is such an interesting script. That's one where they did kind of do the Lethal Weapon thing a little bit, where he and Damon Wayans were like, you know, cop buddies. They were always arguing. I mean, not that Damon Wayans was a cop, or even Bruce Willis was. He's supposed to be a private detective, but it fell into that genre. But I think that film is so good, and I think that it's everything down the line of that, from the story to the villains. I love the
photography.
Taylor Negron, you know, who played the main henchman, you know.
The late Taylor Negron, yeah.
The late Taylor Negron. I will watch, there's a scene in that movie that I watch all the time where they just capture Bruce Willis and he's unconscious, and they come in, they slap his face, and they're like, wake him up, make sure, you know. And Bruce Willis grabs his hand and he tells the guy,
if you touch me again, I'll kill you.
And then the guy does punch him in the face again, and then Willis kills him. And he, by literally just sticking his nose through his brain by doing some move. That's
Kim Coates, by the way, that he killed.
That's Kim Coates, and that hand. Here's another story for you. The hand that actually went up to push to knock Kim Coates' nose through his brain, that's Charlie Paterni's hand.
Charlie Paterni's hand. Okay.
Yeah, he's still quite there on that one as well. So again, we're bringing in some of the Die Hard crew. And Paterni told me that story that the late great Tony Scott, like, that's another reason why The Last Boy Scout to me works so well, is that Tony Scott is one of the all time great directors, in my opinion. I love him and I miss his work. And that was a film that he did. And they went to Paterni and they said, how, you know, the script is kind of vague. Like, what's the best way to kill a guy by just punching him in the face? And Paterni did, you know, put on the jacket that Willis's character is supposed to be wearing and did that shot. And I love that. It's such an awesome scene to just kind of.
Let's talk about Charlie for a second, because you said you did remember a story or two about the second.
Well, just that he was saying that he felt in Die Hard 2 the director was a little bit out of his element, and like he basically Pacioni directed all of Second Unit, and like the entire Annex Skyway shootout. He said like I directed that whole action. I mean, it's not anything like over the top, but just that. I guess Pacioni was given even more kind of responsibilities on the second film than on the first one, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
And did a lot of that action stuff, you know?
So for people who don't know, so Charlie Pacioni, the whole Pacioni family basically are like just legendary stunt performers. You can see Charlie in the first Die Hard when Dwayne Robinson shows up?
Yeah.
He's driving the car.
Yeah.
So he like races this sort of sedan into the, you know, front of the Nakatomi Plaza and like screeches in and just jumps out with Paul Gleason playing Dwayne Robinson. And it's just, you know, it's just funny to see him, but you could see him all over. So, you know, it's like Pacioni, and it's like seeing Chuck Tamburo, the stunt pilot, flying those helicopters. Like they're just, those guys were the guys. If you were going to do stunts and you were going to do action in the 80s,
in the 90s. I just saw Pacioni posted on his Facebook page this morning a behind-the-scenes video of him on Demolition Man. So, I mean, those, you know, there was an there during that Joel Silver, like late 80s, early 90s era, he was his guy for doing that. He did Roadhouse. I mean, we already talked about that. That's another Pacioni movie. So, I mean,
So also, you know, let's just talk about that for a second. Like, Joel Silver was a maniac in the 80s, just a crazy man. On the first film, he wasn't even the lead producer, right? Because in the first Die Hard, it was Larry Gordon, who had been an executive at Fox and then left the executive suite and moved into producing. And there was a lot of bad blood between Larry and Joel at the end of that movie. And basically Joel kind of inherited the Die Hard franchise at that point. But if you look at the credits of Joel Silver, for anybody that doesn't know, I mean, The Matrix and as we're talking now, Last Boy Scout, Joel was the guy, Lethal Weapon, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So yeah. We have a lot to thank Joel Silver for, no matter how crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Last Boy Scout. That's one where I do watch that probably about once a year. I wish they'd done more. I felt like it was kind of set up to be a franchise at the end of the film. And it's too bad that it was.
I would have liked to see more Joe Hallenbeck stories.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. And the film made money. I mean, it wasn't a blockbuster, but I want to say it did like $60 or $70 million in 1991. I mean, that's you know, for an action film like that, that was solid money. So it was definitely a hit. It wasn't a blockbuster, but it made money. And it's too bad that
if I'm not mistaken, that was also the first real role for Halle Berry.
Yeah, that was early on. Yeah, that was one. Her first movie was something just before that called Strictly Business that came out in spring of 91. Mm-hmm. This came out in December. Yeah, early definitely for Halle Berry. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I do often wonder what was it about it that didn't quite connect on the level of, you know, Die Hard and stuff like that. I wonder if it's...
Well, Lethal Weapon or a lot of those films, it did well, but it didn't really break through into the, you know, pop culture, the zeitgeist, like immediately, like the Lethal Weapon series and Die Hard did.
But do you feel like, I mean, obviously guys like us sort of, you know, it's our number three of Bruce Willis's entire career, but like, do you feel like for the average person that it's sort of stood the test of time and is still, you know?
I think for anybody that is a fan of this era of action movies that we're talking about, Roadhouse, Tango and Cash, like that era of cop action movies from the 80s and 90s, absolutely. I mean, I don't, you know, it's one of those films and it just come up in conversation 30 years later, but as you and I are talking.
Didn't they release a DVD where it was like, it was that and Last Man Standing together?
Yeah, I'm looking at it on my shelf right now. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like, why put it with that movie? Like,
it's on Blu-ray. Yeah. It's because Warner Brothers owned them both. And that's the only reason. Warner Brothers did Blu-ray sets for a while where I have Three Kings and I think Body of Lies, which is kind of odd. Those two go together because they just both happen to do with Afghanistan.
Whatever they wanted.
Yeah, just things that they would go, okay, these are similar genres. So, yeah, so Warner Brothers put out a Blu-ray 2-disc set. It was one package, but it was 2 different discs of The Last Boy Scout. And what was the other one we just said? The 1985 film? Yeah,
The Last Man Standing.
Last Man Standing, which I'm not a big fan of. But, yeah, I do own that, but I don't think I've ever put in Last Man Standing into my Blu-ray player. It's always Last Boy Scout.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's one other film. This is definitely not on my top anything, but it came out in April of 91, so the same year. Mortal Thoughts. You know this film with Demi Moore and Bruce?
Vaguely.
It's a really, like, I'm not going to go into a whole thing about it, but it's a really interesting film where Bruce Willis is this husband who's beating up, you know, his wife, whatever, played by Demi Moore, his real life wife at the time. And they end up killing him and getting rid of his body. And he played just a real asshole, just a real piece of shit in the film. And he's really good at it. And it's just an interesting, one of those early 90s kind of mid-range budget thriller movies. And it's good. It's definitely worth revisiting if you're a fan of that kind of genre, and certainly a Bruce Willis or Demi Moore fan. It's really well done.
All right, so this is where I have a feeling we're going to diverge in our top 5 Bruce Willis.
Yeah, and everything, it kind of goes downhill from here too, I have to say, because, you know, going through Bruce Willis's career, like, he's done so many films, and none of them, I mean, there's some real dogs, there's a couple terrible, none of them are really that just fantastic. I mean, a lot of them, he just
Color of Night, Striking Distance.
Yeah, like, nothing's there. And those films you just said, even like The Whole Nine Yards and whatever, they're not terrible movies, but they're not that great either. So for me, I'd have to say number 4 would probably be Armageddon, which, again, Armageddon is not like some stellar piece of work, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. It is fun. I mean, I'll tell you, it didn't make my list, but only because it's not really Bruce's film. It's purely an ensemble film. And actually, I would say if it's anybody's movie, it's kind of Affleck's movie.
I would disagree with that. I think it's an ensemble film for sure. But I do think that Bruce is clearly the anchor that everything is built around. But I agree with you. It's not your typical Bruce Willis film where he's in every single shot. But at that time, 1997, when he was cast in that, I mean, he was one of the biggest movie stars in the world. And that was a big, big get to put him in that film, because that was an era where when they were going to do, you know, $175 million disaster film, they wanted to have a gigantic movie star. Whereas now it probably would be like Robert Pattinson or whatever. They just put someone in there. But back then they wanted the biggest stars in the world for movies like that.
Yeah. So, well, and it was also, you know, that was the period where Jerry Bruckheimer was plucking, you know, Oscar winners and stuff for
sure.
His movies. And people were like, boy, he's either paying them a ton of money or I don't know, because, you know, for him to be getting Hackman for 2 movies and, like, you know, I mean, he was getting Duvall. He was getting all the classic actors to be like second fiddle to whoever the lead was.
Well, I think that, and those actors were happy to do it because they were being paid a shit ton of money, I'm sure. But yeah, also, they realistically, I'm sure they looked at new, like, Jerry Bruckheimer films were like the, you know, the brass ring as far as those kind of movies go. You know, I mean, as far as big budget films, I mean, that, you know, that's fantastic.
Well,
you know?
And it has to be said too. I mean, like, so, you know, some people would look at these sort of older statesman actors and be like, well, they're slumming for a paycheck. But if you look, you know, not to step off the Bruce Willis, but if you look at Days of Thunder or you look at Enemy of the State, they're not slumming in their performances.
No, not at all.
Those guys are killing it in those movies. I mean, Hackman and Crimson Tide, they are killing it in those movies.
Absolutely. Yeah. And frankly, Duvall in Days of Thunder steals the movie from Tom Cruise, absolutely, which is not easy to do. But when you think about Days of Thunder, I'm more thinking about what Duvall did than what Cruise did. And that's really a bold statement, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Armageddon's your number 4. My number 4.
Number 4, yeah.
Is actually his second collaboration with M. Night Shyamalan. I chose Unbreakable.
Wow. Interesting. See, that wouldn't even come close for me.
I just think it was so, it's not so different from what he did in Sixth Sense, because both movies are this very sort of taciturn, depressed, guy, but it was such a different Bruce. You know, Bruce is the cocky guy. Bruce is the confident guy in everything, even Last Boy Scout. You know, he's Joe Hallenbeck is down on his luck and just kind of a shitheel of a guy who like smoke a cigarette that somebody else threw on the sidewalk, right? But he's still cocky. He's still got this walk and this sort of like vibe. And in Unbreakable, he's a guy whose like marriage is crumbling. He doesn't have the best relationship with his son, but he's finding out that he maybe has this, you know, these abilities and this power. And it's such an interesting performance, which, you know, the sequel did not, to be honest, I couldn't even really get through it. I was hopeful for it. But this idea that it's a superhero origin story, but set in a very real sort of average reality, Philadelphia, you know, this guy who works security for a sports stadium. It was a fascinating performance, and the way that he sort of arced that character, you know, I mean, I'm sure a lot of that is what Shyamalan wrote, but the way that Bruce plays it.
Well, and he's in every scene of that film. I mean, it's one of those things where it is a true Bruce Willis movie.
And the opening is like, you know, he's on a train and he's flirting with this cute young girl that gets on the train, and he's like, you know, sort of sneakily tries to take off his wedding ring. And he's just like he's kind of like an unsympathetic character who the way that he changes as he starts to realize that maybe he has these powers, and it's kind of his son, Spencer Tree Clark from Gladiator, who's sort of like believes it before he does. And I just think it's a really interesting performance. So that's why Unbreakable made my number four.
Well, it's definitely not mine, but I'll give you a little Unbreakable trivia. I saw Unbreakable in November of 2000 in Portland, Oregon, on a weekend off from working on the film Bandits with Bruce Willis every single day. So not just a little bit of insider trivia.
By the way, before we get out, I'm going to ask you for any stories about BW.
Sure.
So Unbreakable for me, I just think it's just an impressive performance from Bruce. What's your number five?
You know, that you go first, because that's a hard one for me. I mean, I've got a couple that I like okay, but don't love. You know what? I'll tell you one that's really interesting. I wouldn't say it's like one of my all-time favorites at all, but it's interesting for Bruce is Death Becomes Her. That was at a time when he was, you know, the biggest star in the world in the early 90s, and he did something just very, very different, you know, where he played this kind of Weasley guy, and he went through different makeup iterations because the film took place over a couple different time periods, and he was funny in it, and it was just different for him.
Super, super weird movie. For people who don't know, it's a Robert Zemeckis movie, but Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn and the supporting cast is really weird. I mean, it's just a strange movie.
It's a weird movie. It's a very, very black, dark comedy.
Yeah.
You know,
it didn't really work at the box office. It was not a hit. It was a universal
bomb, but it just did okay. Like it was middle of the road stuff.
But
yeah.
I think people did sort of respect Willis for you know, taking a bold step.
For sure.
Because he was also playing kind of an older guy, he had the mustache.
Yeah.
He was letting the bald spot kind of
show. That's what I'm saying. He had prosthetics on because he was playing at one iteration of the character as much older than what Bruce Willis was, you know? So it was kind of a swing for him, you know? It's something that his agents were probably like, what are you doing? Like, this is a weird thing. This is not your movie. This is Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep's film. You're kind of the third banana, and it's a weird deal. And, you know, and he probably was like, screw it, I want to go do something totally different. So I respect him for that.
Yeah.
Outside of that, like, I like
what went into your number five.
I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I don't know that I really have a number five. I mean, would you say Pulp Fiction? I mean, like,
no, so
I agree. It's not a Bruce Willis film.
Yeah, Pulp Fiction is in my honorable mention, but it's
not. Jackal. I don't like, you know, but that's another thing. I don't think The Jackal is anything just over the top great, but I do like.
Not a good movie.
I like the international kind of aspect of it. I like Richard Gere. I like that they're kind of like two different characters on two different trajectories chasing after each other. Number five's hard for me. What's your number five?
My number five is 12 Monkeys.
Interesting. Yeah. And see, that's one that I've never really loved. It was just kind of like
another
too
one.
Weird
it's
for me.
Another one where he took a bold swing. It's
for
a
sure.
Strange character. It's a character who has like this wicked amnesia through most of it. He doesn't understand. His brain keeps getting scrambled because he's time traveling, keeps getting pushed through time. It's a Terry Gilliam movie, so it's weird anyway, but it has this phenomenal supporting cast. You got Madeline Stowe, you got David Morse, and you got Brad Pitt in his Golden Globe nominated role as a supporting actor. He's just really weird. The whole movie is just weird. The design, everything about it.
It came out in one of those periods where Bruce was really doing the old movie star concept of like one for them and one for me. You know, like he would do 12 Monkeys came out right after Die Hard 3, you know, and Die Hard 3 came out right after Nobody's Fool, where he played a supporter, which is totally just a different film where he's playing, you know, this just kind of normal guy in this movie that's not his movie. It's Paul Newman's
supporting role. Yeah. Right.
And before that, Color of Night, which is a big Bruce Willis movie, which was a horrendous piece of garbage. I went and saw it in the theater, you know, but it was like a big Bruce Willis erotic thriller. And before that, he did Pulp Fiction, you know, a year before. Yeah. So he really was doing the big budget film, the big, you know, studio thing, and then go off and do like a supporting role. So he was really, you could tell he was stretching his muscles back then and going, I want to do this, I want to do that.
Well,
you
know, I think he was looking for interesting directors.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, for sure.
You know, like
Terry Gilliam and Tarantino
or
Zemeckis.
He was just like, let me try and work with some real filmmakers now who have a real vision and all that. Yeah. I'll just
Tony Scott. I mean, Tony Scott, at that point, it was coming off of Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Revenge, and Days of Thunder. Those are all interesting
stuff. Like, I'll just sort of like follow their lead. I'll just kind of go where they want to go.
Well, you know, that's what the great all-time actors did. You look at Tom Cruise's career. I mean, every director he worked with since, you know, 85, 86 has been like, literally just the most A-list of the A-list directors. And same thing with DiCaprio, you know, I mean, you look at what they've done, that's why their films, you know, they didn't follow like the Ben Affleck, you know, or one of those guys where they just kind of went off and did paycheck roles.
Yeah. No, they
went whatever directors, you know.
You know, Cruise very clearly had a list of the greatest filmmakers. He'd already worked with Coppola. You know, he was checking off a list of filmmakers one by one and going through all of them.
Oliver Stone, Barry Levinson. Yeah. I mean,
But I'll also say that Willis in sort of his later career, and I know you probably don't watch a lot of the movies, but like Wes Anderson, he did a couple. He did Moonrise Kingdom, which he's really wonderful in a different way. He's, you know, it's a bit of a heightened thing, but he's really great in it.
Yeah.
Looper, I think, was probably... I didn't love the film, but Rian Johnson was a director on the rise. I think Bruce probably liked Brick, which was the film that he had done earlier, like his breakout film. So, you know, strange movie. But I think that Bruce at that point was, you know, again, like, how can I do something different? How can I just do something where I can just sort of like get in his... And neither one of us, interestingly, neither one of us brought up The Fifth Element.
I don't like that film. I'm not a fan of it at all. It's just it's too out there. I mean, it's weird. I saw that in the theater, and it's really weird because Bruce Willis is playing like his typical Bruce Willis role in that, you know, kind of snarky. 100%. And I mean, it's almost like he's playing John McClane in the future and whatever.
Yeah.
I just hated the movie. I remember seeing it the first time in the theater. I don't think I've seen it again. That was 25 years ago. So, and I know that the film is well liked in a lot of circles and well remembered, but I've revisited it and
I do enjoy it. It's super strange, and it's just sort of like a light, fluffy, airy movie that you can just like, you don't even have to pay that much attention to it, but it's just fun and it's kind of goofy.
I don't think
it takes itself seriously, which is, you know, if you look at like Hudson Hawk, right, which was purely a Bruce Willis vehicle, that was like
his
thing. He wanted to make that movie. He pushed that movie to Silver and got it made. It's constantly winking at the audience, but at the same time is taking itself seriously. And that's why I think it didn't work. Whereas The Fifth Element knows that it's silly. The Fifth Element knows that it's silly and just is like, you know, just sit back, just take the ride. This is goofy, but it's fun. Because it had Gary Oldman in there, you know, it just took it to a different level. But yeah, so my honorable mention was Pulp Fiction because, I mean, what a phenomenal cultural shift of a movie, and his portrayal of Butch, it is really incredible. And the fact that you don't even get to him for a long time in that movie. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he was the biggest name in it, but he was not the lead.
It's probably one of those things that Miramax was like, okay, cool. We got Bruce Willis and he's doing it at scale and we can kind of slap him on the poster. Great. You know, even though, yeah.
But yeah. You know, but, and he was again, you know, talking about coming out of like Nobody's Fool with Newman. He was at a point where he was like, I don't need to be the lead. I'm good. I got money. I'm fine. Let me do interesting work with interesting people. And so he takes a back seat to somebody like Travolta or whatever in the movie, even though he's the biggest star. He's the only, he and Sam Jackson, the only ones that like walk away alive in the movie pretty much. So,
yeah.
So that was an honorable mention. Then I also had as an honorable mention, his cameo in Loaded Weapon 1.
That's so funny. Cause I was going to bring that up, but I figured for sure that you wouldn't know, even know that reference.
Oh God, I love it.
Yeah. I watched that recently for the first time in many, many years. I watched that and me and Irina turned
that
it on.
That movie's hilarious.
It's really funny. It's a shame they didn't sequelize that since it was obviously set up from day one to do that. But yeah, him in the tank top and waving the flag.
It's like a hybrid of it's Riggs's, you know, RV on the beach from Lethal Weapon 1 and 2.
Yeah.
But it's Bruce in his diehard tank top inside there. And whole thing hilarious. Is
the audience thing saw that. I saw that in an advanced screening in a packed theater and the audience went wild. I mean, that was probably the biggest laugh of the film.
The thing that makes it for me is like, you know, for people that have never seen it or whatever, it's like the Lethal Weapon 2 scene where the helicopters come in off the water off the ocean and they just shoot up this RV that's on the beach, just destroy it. And they blow it up. And then all of a sudden this white flag comes up and you're expecting like, oh, are we getting Mel Gibson here? Are we getting somebody mm-hmm. pretending to be Mel Gibson? And instead it's Willis in his, you know, for non PC term, his wife beater from Die Hard. And he stands up and the shooters are like,
this 1014 Pacific Coast Highway. 1014 Pacific Coast Highway.
No! This is 814 Pacific Coast Highway. 1014 is 2 blocks up that way.
Sorry, my mistake.
Yeah, no problem. No problem.
What gets me every time is he gets no the problem. Last. He gets the last
no
line.
Problem.
No problem. No problem.
Just looking around at his blown up home. No problem.
He looks so like upset, like legitimately upset. It's really fantastic. So yeah.
I got one honorable mention, and then we'll wrap up our Bruce Willis show. But here it is. Friends. He did, I think, a 3 or 4 episode arc in Friends in 2000. And he was really, really funny in those episodes. He really came to play with those characters and he was great. The audience loved him. And those are some of the funnier episodes. I mean, Friends has had a lot of great episodes, but I mean, those were just memorable ones that he just came in there. And I think the reason he did it is because he had just filmed the whole 9 yards with
Matthew Perry.
Yeah, with Matthew Perry. So he came in, you know, there's a favorite of Perry to play this role, and he's really funny. It was 3 episodes. He was great.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was willing to have some fun back then.
So, you know, Bruce, it's been widely announced and people are well aware. He's been sort of forced into retirement because of a condition called aphasia, where his sort of memory is beginning to slip. It's not unlike dementia, a form of dementia. So unfortunately, we will not be getting any more Bruce Willis performances in his later years, like some of his contemporaries.
You talked about this being on the show. I did an entire movie with Bruce Willis called Bandits. We filmed it back in 2000. It was him and Billy Bob Thornton and Cate Blanchett. And we filmed it over 4 months in Northern California and Oregon. And it was one of those movies where Bruce and Billy Bob are in like every single scene. So literally he was on set every single day. And yeah, he was just a class act. Not, you know, he's not, you know, you have actors that are kind of hang out with the crew and know everybody's name and whatever. And then you have actors who like, don't, you know, you're not allowed to look them in the eye, you know, we know those kind of actors too. And Bruce fell kind of in the middle of that, where he's very professional, was always on time, and you know, and I mean, he, you know, it wasn't a challenging role, frankly. I mean, it was, he was basically just playing a version of himself in that, just kind of the smart alecky, good looking, cocky guy, you know. So it was an easy part for him to do, but he was great in it. And what I do remember is he would hold parties for the crew. That movie, the movie's interesting because it is a road movie. Like, it takes place over several states. And as a crew, it was a road movie for us. Like, we were in Portland, Oregon for about 5 weeks. But then by the time we left there, we started to go to Northern California, and we hit like 5 or 6 towns, you know, and we're staying at different hotels and different towns and little
places. So were you shooting that in continuity?
For the most part, actually, yeah. Yeah, because when they wrapped up in L.A., where they come to L.A. and they rob a bank in L.A. at the finale, which, ironically enough, is right down the street from the Die Hard Fox Tower, literally down the street from. And I always thought that was interesting that, you know, we're filming Bruce Willis here, to literally I'd look over to my left and there is the iconic Die Hard building that he'd filmed in 12 years earlier.
Right.
But yeah, it was pretty much filmed in continuity. We shot in an actual prison for about a week and a half up outside of Portland, where they break out. Barry Levinson directed the film. And it's a fine film. I mean, it's not, you know, it's one of those movies you kind of forget as easily as, you know, as it's over. It's certainly not top anything.
Yeah.
But it's not a bad movie. It's a fun little film. And he and Billy Bob, who'd become friends on Armageddon, have a really good chemistry together.
So other than sort of saying like "Ready for you, Bruce," or "What ready for you, BW," or whatever, did you ever have any interaction with him?
No. I did not, but I will say that.
Did you win scholarship days or anything?
You know, you hear something funny.
Just tell people really quickly what that is. You know, Bruce had for a little while not a great reputation amongst sort of, you know, workaday crew or union crew, and I think part of, you know, his idea to fix that was most shows, films would have what we call $5 Friday. And a PA gets chosen and has to like walk around with this plastic bucket that you get from craft service, and you cut a little hole in the top, and people write their name or their, you know, name and department on whatever, a dollar or a $5 bill or $10 bill. And they put it in there, and you try and get as many people as a PA. You walk around all day. You try and get as many people to contribute to that pot as you can. And then at the end of the day, either the director or the actor or the producer will open the lid and take one bill out and unfold it and say the name of the person. Whoever that person is gets all the money in the pot. And Bruce started what he was calling scholarship days, which is where whatever the pot got to from the average crew people, he would sweeten the pot at the end of the day and usually get, you know, some co-stars to kick in as well. So go ahead, Roberts.
No, here's the deal. You had to, if you left the movie early, you didn't win. And this entire film, and he was getting out a lot of money because the whole movie's on location. So every single week, they were giving him an envelope with probably $10,000 in per diem.
Per diem, yeah.
Yeah. So he had a ton of loose cash on that. So some weeks, you know, he'd pull four or five names out and everybody would win $500, $1,000, whatever. And this entire 12-week period, man, shit, it was like 15, 16 weeks. No, my name didn't get pulled. I left the movie a week and a half early to go work on a much worse film called A Man Apart with Vin Diesel. And I heard that the last week my name was pulled. And they were like, oh, yeah, he's not here anymore. Go to the next name. So, no, I did not win. I didn't have any direct conversation with Bruce because on that film, there were four staff PAs, and I was – kind of run in the background. Like that was not one of my jobs where I was like right there at camera with the first AD. There were two other PAs that had that position. Okay. So I was, you know, not always directly in the middle of set. You know, I kind of had like the job you had on Matrix Reloaded is kind of what I was doing on that show.
Okay. But I mean, Bruce was cool and he was cool, not exactly man of the people, but he wasn't a jerk either.
Not at all. No. And there's so many actors that I'm not going to name that are the exact opposite, you know, that are, you know, like literally it's like you can't even look them in the eye, even though you're working every day on the same set with him for 4 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that at all. No. So I do remember him as being a very much class act.
All right, folks. Well, that is our Bruce Willis top five. I knew we'd be aligned in our at least our first three. I knew that. So
I was not expecting Last Boy Scout to be your number three, so I'm happy to hear that. Because you and I have talked about that movie before, and I think what was taken from that is that I like the movie more than you do, so I was happy to hear that it made your top three.
Yeah, no, and I You're went smart. Down the whole IMDb and was like, boy, you know, what is? But no, I revisit it, so that's why it made it.
Yeah, so. For sure.
We will eventually get around to, as Robert's mentioned earlier, a Stallone episode where we'll sort
of... For sure. We can do that like in the next month or so, because I've been on a Stallone kick lately and I'm really excited about... Or maybe wait and do it in November in a few months when Tulsa King premieres, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
You know, we'll coincide it around mid-November when that premieres and do a whole Stallone retrospective, because that'll be a fun one to do a top five on, I think.
That sounds good to me, man. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of Stage 16. We will collect a bunch more information and news, latest Hollywood news and gossip and stuff, and we'll come back to you in about a month's time.
All right. More or less.
Thanks, everybody.